This podcast was already recorded before we learned that Susan Rice, who might have been the president's choice to be his next Secretary of State in his second term, has asked for her name to be withdrawn. We will deal with this news development at the end of the podcast in a special addendum. Stay tuned. Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, you seem extra happy today.
I am incredibly happy today, Ken. And do you know why?
I don't.
My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over.
That's right. It's finally over. Our national nightmare is over.
Podcast has been canceled?
No, the election of 2012.
Oh,
the entire thing.
It's officially
over. The primaries,
over.
The debates, the conventions, all of it. It's finally done. The last one was done in the state of Louisiana.
How's by you?
It was the race for the last House seat, the 435th House seat. It was won by
Charles Bustany, Louisiana's 3rd congressional district. Charles Bustany defeated Jeff Landry, 2 Republicans put together because of redistricting, and Louisiana loses one seat. And Charles Bustany had the geography. He had the money. He was close with Speaker Boehner. He had seniority. And Jeff Landry was backed by the Tea Party, but Bustany won pretty big, like 60-40.
Okay, kind of a little bit of a surprise there because
the margin.
The margin, yeah. and also Bustany being the winner because, as you say, he's a little bit close to Speaker John Boehner. And right now, well, is John Boehner at the zenith of his power? Is he at the peak? Is he way up there? Or is he actually more or less struggling under this burden of fiscal cliff discussion and, well, not getting a lot of progress in his negotiations with the president?
Before we go to the president part of this equation, let's talk about Boehner and his fellow Republicans. It seems like he has more of a coalescing figure than he was in 2011. I don't know if maybe because the Tea Party was flexing its muscles after their great victory in 2010, but there seems to be less outright rebellion against Boehner, at least as of now, than there was a year or so ago. At the same time, I would say that President Obama, feeling perhaps shell-shocked after what happened in 2010, seemed to be more willing to give up stuff than he is now. So I think both sides have been strengthened. But the real question is whether Boehner can hold on to this unity, because ultimately the conventional wisdom, which is not always right, but the conventional wisdom seems to be he's going to have to give up more than he gets. And if that's the case, the Jim DeMint of the House may not be that happy.
That's right. Now, of course, Jim DeMint is a former House member who has been in the Senate for the last 8 years and has just shared with us earlier this month and on an earlier podcast his plan to leave the Senate at the end of this month and become the president of the Heritage Foundation and have some real standing in this town and be a real spokesperson from the conservative movement. We've talked already about how that's kind of surprising, but Boehner does seem to be in a stronger position now, if only because his number two guy, the House Majority Leader, Eric Cantor, whose title is Majority Leader, but who's actually number two to the Speaker, John Boehner, has not been quite so, shall we say, hovering in the background, you know, sort of waiting for that moment when Boehner might look challengeable. Cantor's kind of backed off. Some of the other leaders
Paul
of the
Ryan
Tea Party,
seems
Paul
to be
Ryan,
in line.
Some of these folks, Mike Pence is leaving the House to become governor of Indiana, just having been elected to that in November. So a lot of his rivals for power that he's been struggling to hold at arm's length for the last several years seem to have stepped back a little bit to see whether or not Boehner will sink or swim. And, of course, sink or swim means how does he resolve this fiscal cliff business with the president. Here he is on the floor of the House this week talking about some of their meetings.
A lot of people know that the president and I met on Sunday. It was a nice meeting. It was cordial. But we're still waiting for the White House to identify what spending cuts the president is willing to make as part of the balanced approach that he promised the American people. You know, where are the president's spending cuts? And the longer the White House slow walks this process, the closer our economy gets to the fiscal cliff.
Now, I'm not convinced that John Boehner is saying one thing to the president in private conversations and another to his fellow Republicans.
You think he is saying two different things?
I think he is. I think the speech he gave on the floor of the House, he has to give to make sure the conservatives know that he's not giving away the store, that he's really standing up for principle. He's not going to give more. He's not going to give in to Obama's demands. Whereas at the same time, I kind of think that the fact that Obama and Boehner are still talking, that for all the, you know, the speeches that everybody's making, if a deal is going to happen, I think both sides want a deal to happen, it's going to be between the two of them.
You know, here's the real problem, though, that Boehner has to deal with, and that is that this particular negotiation, this particular confrontation with the president has been framed in quite a different way from what we've seen before. We've seen, are they going to raise the debt limit? Well, that sounds like more deficit spending, and of course it does imply more deficit spending. This time, and for the first time I can remember in a long while, the big confrontation issue seems to be, are we going to let tax rates go up on the top 2%, the wealthiest people in the country? That's the way the issue has been framed. And this is highly unusual for it to be framed in such a way as to be so favorable to the president's position as opposed to the conservatives' position in Congress. That puts John Boehner in a really difficult negotiating position.
Yeah, I think the White House and the Democrats early defined this as being, are the Republicans willing to bring down tax cuts for the middle class to protect the 2% of the wealthy?
That's right. Everybody's taxes are going to go up if we go off the cliff. That's what the cliff is about.
And I think, first of all, I think the majority of the American public will blame both sides, probably justifiably. But if somebody has an edge in this, the political part of this, it seems definitely like the White House and the Democrats. Now, at the same time, what's the incentive for giving up stuff?
Because he wants a long-term global deal. He wants to see the debt limit, this business that we have to come back every year, year and a half, and authorize a larger debt limit. He wants to get rid of that. He wants to get rid of all of this discussion that is so freezing the federal government, freezing expectations in business world, getting people to invest money. Again, there's a lot of cash sitting on the sideline in the American economy, and we could see a real spurt of growth in 2013, many believe, many economists say, and it stands to a kind of common reason. If we could eliminate all this uncertainty about the role of the biggest player in our economy, and that's the federal government. So if they could get a global deal and he could say, yes, we're going to lessen to some degree the value of Social Security for future generations. We're going to somewhat slim down the value of Medicare for future generations. But we're protecting the neediest and we're making them richest pay more, and that's all part of this one big deal. I think that's what brings the president not just the admiration of his own supporters, the people who voted for him in November, but of a substantially larger part of the total population, and really gives him a chance to start his second term on a big up note with a big economic surge.
Which is not what the Republican Party would like to see happen. And what happens to the Republican Party? What happens to John Boehner if the feeling is, we, the Republicans, gave up much more than what we got?
Primaries. Yeah, that's what happens. What happens in 2014 is that there's a letter out from conservatives urging Republicans in the House and Senate to hold the line 100%. And this letter is signed by about 100 people. And it's a total who's who of the people who have made the conservative movement over the last 30, 35 years, you know, back to the Reagan era. And those people are quite sincere, I'm sure, in demanding that John Boehner give up nothing, even though John Boehner has no cards to play that I can see.
That was my question, right?
I see no cards for him to play, except he is being told by his hardest core supporters in the base of the Republican Party, don't give an inch.
We talked in the last podcast about the role of Jim DeMint, the resigning senator from South Carolina, and the kind of candidates he pushed forward, the Christine O'Donnells, the Richard Murdochs, the Ted Cruz, the Marco Rubios. Some won, some didn't. Some of them kept Republican seats. Some of them forfeited victories, like Christine O'Donnell in Delaware, that the Republicans should have won. But with DeMint gone, there may be others who will stand up and say, look, you know, I'd rather, again, lose on principle than win with compromise, and I'd rather lose with true conservatives than win with rhinos.
There is a true argument here, a real disagreement among conservatives, generally speaking, as to whether they're better off making a compromise with Barack Obama and being seen as part of the accommodation of Washington and therefore the overall long-term growth of the federal government, or whether they're better off forcing a situation that may be highly unpopular and, at least in the short run, run, inimical to their political health by forcing the fiscal cliff or by doing other things, for example, allowing the United States to default on its obligations when we next hit the debt ceiling, which is coming up in February.
I kind of think that the course they'll take is the latter, because if you looked at the polls on how the public views Congress was abysmal in 2011, and yet the Republican Party was not about to back down from their core principles. They said, look, you know, the public opinion be damned. This is exactly how we feel, and this is exactly what we ran on, and this is why we were elected.
Yes, and that's especially interesting when you look at this past week in Michigan. Now, here is a state that went pretty easily for President Obama in the election. They have two pretty liberal Democratic senators. But in 2010, with the big Republican tide running there as elsewhere in the country, they elected a conservative Rick Snyder as their governor. They elected pretty good-sized legislative majorities for the Republicans.
Both chambers, right?
And now we have seen in this past week the payoff of that. They have passed a right-to-work law. Now, a lot of other states have, too, but they're mostly in the South and in the Mountain West, for a big industrial state like Michigan.
Wait, we're talking Michigan. If you think of union power in any state in the country, it's
U-A-W.
Michigan.
U-A-W.
Which stands for union power. Mm-hmm. In Michigan. And you think of Jimmy Hoffa and the Teamsters and all the auto workers and the years they've spent on being the union capital of the country. And you wonder, and the question, of course, is this something that could be contagious and spread around or across the country, or could this come back to bite the Republicans as it kind of did in Ohio with SB 5, with the collective bargaining restrictions in Wisconsin that led to almost recall.
But
it wasn't successful.
And to a pretty good Democratic year in some respects in the presidential election, the Senate election, and so on. It did not indicate that the state of Wisconsin had taken the big right turn that some people thought it had.
Right, exactly. I mean, they were not successful in the recall of Governor Walker, but they still got a million signatures to get that issue on the ballot, and that shows pretty strong labor strength. So you wonder whether what happened in Michigan either awakens a sleeping giant and unions come back with retribution in 2014. They get rid of Governor Snyder. They get rid of the Republicans in the legislature. Or, you know, somehow the economy in Michigan improves and it gets the Republicans and the business folks say, aha, what we did succeeded.
That's right. And the president, interestingly enough, in a move that may not have typified his first term, was willing to weigh into the middle of this, to go out to Michigan, to campaign actively there, both for his position on the fiscal cliff negotiations, but also campaign quite actively against the right to work law and throw his lot in foursquare with the union movement in a way that he hasn't always done with big labor in his first 4 years in office.
You know, these so-called right-to-work laws, they don't have to do with economics. They have everything to do with politics. What they're really talking about is giving you the right to work for less money. You only have to look to Michigan, where workers were instrumental in reviving the auto industry, to see how unions have helped build not just a stronger middle class, but a stronger America.
Speaking of governors first elected in 2010 who have monumental decisions in front of them, him or her, it's a her in this case in South Carolina, Nikki Haley, the governor there, is now faced with a choice of whom to appoint to the U.S. Senate now that Jim DeMint is leaving next month, and she has some interesting choices.
Well, the most interesting choice, I think, would either be Jenny Sanford, who is, of course, the former wife of the former governor who left the governorship after his illicit affair with a South American woman was exposed.
Well, he was his soulmate.
Apparently.
Yeah.
And so now, of course, Jenny Sanford is still a prominent figure in the state. She has attracted a lot of national attention and admiration for the way she handled that extremely difficult situation.
Even more than that, though,
she endorsed Nikki Haley when Nikki Haley ran
right.
in 2010.
She ran Mark Sanford's congressional and gubernatorial campaign. She was a top advisor.
She's very smart.
But the other person on the list, of course, is Tim Scott, with Alan West about to be departing. Tim Scott is the only African-American Republican in the Congress, and he would be the only African-American senator from the Deep South since Reconstruction, only the second Republican.
That's right. And, of course, I think at this point, while Jenny Sanford, you know, got a lot of attention when that name went by, and there is another woman as well who's been mentioned on the short list, and a couple of the members of the congressional delegation, other than Tim Scott, no one has anywhere near the power to get enormous national attention as Tim Scott because of those firsts that you mentioned, because of those onlys that you mentioned, and because there is such a general sense that the Republican Party needs to reach out beyond its white and largely male base that we saw on November 6th.
I mean, just naming an African-American senator is not going to attract black votes. There's no question that having Ellen West or Michael Steele as Republican National Chairman is not going to help them make inroads in the African-American community.
Maybe not immediately.
No.
But having, you need to start somewhere.
But having somebody like Tim Scott, who would automatically and immediately become a national figure, I think, is symbolic, but it'll also be some kind of a statement saying, you know, every time we looked at the congressional makeup of the leadership of the Democrats and the Republicans are white men. They had to find Candace Miller of Michigan and maybe
Kathy McMorris Rodgers
of Washington to make it not an all-male thing. But having Tim Scott is symbolic, but it also, I think, sends more than a message. And Nikki Haley has to be aware of this because her numbers in South Carolina are not good. I don't think she'd be opposed by anybody in her own party, but she barely won election in 2010, much closer than expected. And she's had a lot of battles with her fellow Republicans. Either way, either a Jenny Sanford or a Tim Scott decision, whether it helps her or not, would be a monumental decision and could have great implications, not only for the Senate races, because Lindsey Graham is also up in 2014, but for her own reelection.
That's right. And we're also thinking not only about some of these 2014 races, but one race that comes up even sooner than that involving one of our famous Republican governors in 2013.
That's right. And, of course, Chris Christie has announced he will seek a second term.
He will seek a second term, folks.
He could have pulled a Mitt Romney and said, I elected one term in Massachusetts and then prepare to run for president.
Or he could have run for the Senate in 2014. A Frank Lautenberg seat is up.
And one of the leading Democrats in New Jersey is also wrestling with that same very decision.
Cory Booker,
the mayor of Newark. Does he run against Chris Christie next year, where Christie's numbers are astronomical in the wake of Hurricane Sandy? Or does he go after Frank Lautenberg, who will be 90 years old in 2014 and has not given any indication whether he's going to run again?
Wow, is that a broad set of hints? I would say that it looks pretty likely he would do the latter. Unless, of course, he wants to launch his statewide career with a loss.
Before we go to other subjects, just one more thing about labor unions. I think you didn't mention the fact that the death of Ravi Shankar, and I think his leadership of the teachers union was a tremendous thing during the 1960s.
Wow. That was just amazing. And, of course, you are confusing Ravi Shankar, legendary Indian sitarist and musician and guru to a generation of American musicians, with Albert Shankar, who was formerly the head of the teachers union in New York City, who died decades ago. Ken, a couple of other prospective candidate stories emerging. We discovered that Charlie Crist is interested in a new political party. He is apparently coming
Well, he's becoming a Republican?
Charlie, of course, was the Republican governor of Florida. When he was not going to get the Republican nomination for the Senate, he decided to run as an independent, lost to Marco Rubio. Now he's a free agent. He went to the Democratic convention in Charlotte. Do you remember?
Yes, he campaigned for President Obama, endorsed him.
Yes, he did. And so what do you know?
He's now an official member of the Democratic Party, and it just so happens that in 2014, where Governor Rick Scott is ostensibly in trouble.
A little shaky.
Shall we say. Now, of course, there are some people like Jeb Bush and other Republicans who said good riddance. Even when he was a Republican, they were not happy with him, but that would be interesting speculation. But why wait for 2014? There's something coming up even sooner, 2016.
Yes, and while we're speculating about people who might come out as Democrats, there's been a lot of talk about Hillary Clinton, our current Secretary of State, former First Lady, former Senator.
We had her once on the podcast.
That's right. And this week she was asked whether she would be on the podcast again.
You know, I've said I really don't believe that's something I will do again.
Well, now, of course, that was not Hillary Clinton talking about being on our podcast. That was Hillary Clinton responding to a question from ABC's Barbara Walters, who was, of course, asking about that other thing, running for president in 2016.
What would it take to convince you to run in 2016?
You know, that's all hypothetical, because right now I have no intention of running. I just want to, I want to make a contribution. I always feel that's who I am and what I want to do.
You wonder what Hillary Clinton is feeling. I mean, obviously,
do I?
Well, one wonders. One wonders what Hillary Clinton is going through. Obviously, she is exhausted. She's about to leave as Secretary of State, by all indications, and she has a decision to make. We saw James Carville, among many others, saying that Hillary Clinton owes it to the Democratic Party, if not the country, to run again in 2016. Do I think she's made a decision? I do not. Do I think she's really torn about what to do? I do think she's torn, but, you know, I think she needs some time off. You're making faces.
I think
Bill Clinton definitely wants it.
Single move she would have needed to have made in order to prepare the ground and to get the party very excited about the prospect has been made. Even down to the video that introduces the candidate and that's been shown at some of these events where people are bidding farewell to her as Secretary of State. I mean, everything that would be necessary has been put in place. Does that mean a final decision? No. Does it mean she has no reservations? Of course not. She has enormous reservations. But I think when it's clear to her, when and if it's clear to her, that the field would be cleared for her, that there would be no sudden new Barack Obama emerging to contest the nomination, as in 2008, if it's clear to her that it's hers, for the asking, she will ask, and she will have the nomination in 2016.
Unlike the last time around, of course, she was not Secretary of State after the 2004 elections, when she was talking about 2008, when everybody said, the pathway to the nomination is clearly yours, you are the clear frontrunner, and she was the clear frontrunner.
She was clearly. She was 30, 40 points ahead.
And nobody saw Barack Obama, but who knows? 2016 is such a long time. Does Joe Biden back out, Martin O'Malley, and Mark Warner, those kind of guys? Look, I don't think she's made a decision. I think she is the prohibitive favorite, but we make such a mistake and we make fools of ourselves, I think. And we, you know how we hate doing that.
I hate doing that.
Exactly. But I really don't know if she knows. And there may be unbelievable pressure. I remember Ted Kennedy kept saying, I don't know, I don't know. And suddenly every Democrat said, you got to save our party from Jimmy Carter. Remember that, what happened that in 1980?
That's a very different situation.
It is.
Against an incumbent of your own party who's seeking a second term is totally different from rescuing a party that otherwise has no consensus nominee. And even when Teddy Kennedy was at his zenith, he was not as popular to the exclusion of all other possible candidates, as Hillary is going into 2016. It could change in the next few years.
I kind of think one of the reasons Hillary Clinton is so popular is because she's clearly not political. I think one of the reasons the Republicans love her so much is, one, she is not Barack Obama, and by professing love for Hillary Clinton, the Republicans could say, here's a Democrat we really like.
Hey, look, I'm bipartisan.
But once she gets into the political arena, once she has to take these positions, this non-political aura disappears. And I think you'll see the brickbats coming from the Republicans once again. That's my guess.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
And as we mentioned earlier, Ken, we're going to add to this particular podcast the news that has just crossed on Thursday afternoon that Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, has asked President Obama not to consider her further as the potential replacement for Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. Kind of a blockbuster. People were expecting this to be the first big fight, if you will, of the 113th Congress. A lot of Republicans in the Senate were saying they couldn't vote for. What happened?
Susan Rice was never officially nominated by President Obama to be the next Secretary of State. Matter of fact, the president never said that she was the leading candidate. And as we should point out, there's not even a vacancy. Hillary Clinton is still the Secretary of State until she runs for president. Having said that, Susan Rice did go up to Capitol Hill to meet with Republican senators like John McCain and Lindsey Graham and Kelly Ayotte to maybe iron out some misunderstandings about Benghazi, things like that. The reception she got was far more negative than she expected, and not only from Lindsey Graham and John McCain, which was expected, but from Susan Collins. If she didn't have a good session with Susan Collins,
possibly the most moderate Republican left in the Senate, in the new Senate,
who is more than likely to give President Obama a break on things like nominations, things like that, if she couldn't sway Susan Collins, then obviously her task was much greater than she thought. And I guess ultimately she said, rather than having to tie up the Senate, tie up the White House, tie up politics for months with a very nasty and prolonged confirmation fight, she withdrew.
That's right, except that one assumes that if the president had said, no, Susan, I'm sorry, we're not going to shrink from this fight. You and I, shoulder to shoulder, we're going up against that Senate. I'm going to get you every vote I can, and you're going to be confirmed, and we're going to tough this one out, and we're going to show them who's boss. If he had given her that kind of response to her supposed resignation letter, Do you think she would have insisted on stepping down? I'm not so sure that she would have stepped back, if you will, if the president had really insisted that he wanted to go forward with this confrontation.
Well, that leads to another question. And, of course, we're doing this addendum within a half hour of learning this news. But if we're going that way, then maybe it was President Obama who said, look, I don't want to have this fight in the Senate. I don't want to spend the first 2 months of my new term battling over this nomination that could very well fail. Maybe the best thing to do is fall on your sword.
It would make sense. That's a rational decision. That's certainly a judgment that he could have reached, or they could have reached together, or perhaps the White House inner circle all reached as a group. But he's going to take a lot of heat. He's going to take heat from women. He's going to take heat for not standing behind a woman who is an African-American after just having won this election on the votes of women and minorities. He's going to take heat from people who like Susan Rice and from some who probably don't really even care about her but see this as their first opportunity to seize upon a moment of presidential weakness after this 5 or 6 weeks he's had of having things mostly going his way.
Another way of looking at it was that maybe if the Republicans wanted to give the president a little, you know, slap in the face, what better way of doing it than sabotage his Secretary of State nominee?
At this point, it appears the consensus will be John Kerry, the senator from Massachusetts, will be the front runner to be the next Secretary of State. We're also hearing Chuck Hagel, the former Republican or former senator who is a Republican from Nebraska, will become the new Secretary of Defense, and Jack Lew, the President's Chief of Staff, is considered the inside guy to be the next Secretary of the Treasury. We'll come back next week and talk a little bit about candidates to be Attorney General.
Before we completely leave John Kerry, of course, remember the Republicans were saying for the longest time, let's do John Kerry because his confirmation would be a breeze. Let's see if that's still a breeze if John Kerry becomes that nominee for Secretary of State. One more thing, if it's John Kerry or if it's Tom Donilon or somebody else, either one would be the first white male Secretary of State since Warren Christopher in 1997.
And speaking of useless trivia, that's it for this week's Political Podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. The podcast was produced by Bracton Booker and edited by Kathy Shaw.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.